Welcome to the New Books Network. This is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. In many American cities, zoos have long been a central part of the urban ecosystem. In his new book, American Zoo, sociologist David Grazian at the University of Pennsylvania takes readers inside zoos in the 21st century to look at how they operate and with what effects on how humans and non-human animals relate. It's based on years of fieldwork as a volunteer educator, and it really is urban. Welcome to the New Books Network. This is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. In many American cities, zoos have long been a central part of the urban ecosystem. In his new book, American Zoo, sociologist David Grazian at the University of Pennsylvania takes readers inside zoos in the 21st century to look at how they operate and with what effects on how humans and non-human animals relate. It's based on years of fieldwork as a volunteer educator, and it really is urban ethnography at its best. The book is smart, fun, readable. I recently had the chance to interview Grazian about American Zoo with 29 students in my course, Healing Animals. David Grazian, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me and the students in Healing Animals about your new book, American Zoo. So I want to start off by asking you about the two big concepts that organize the book. First, authenticity, and then second, the Anthropocene. So just starting with authenticity, you're an urban ethnographer and a cultural sociologist. So this might seem like a little bit of a departure looking at zoos based on your previous work on hip-hop music and these sorts of things. So can you explain what cultural sociologists and urban ethnographers are doing when they're studying authenticity? Why does it matter for zoos?
Sure. So in the contemporary age where so much of our cultural lives seems simulated, seems commercialized, we tend to gravitate toward and invest a lot of meaning and value in cultures, in fashions, in styles, in genres of music, film, art, dance that we think of as authentic, that we think of as being the production of sincerity, as opposed to something performed for an audience for a fee. So sociologists are interested in understanding, at least I am interested in understanding, how people use authenticity as a means of evaluating stuff in the world. And so I'm not so interested in the kinds of questions philosophers might ask about, you know, whether or not something is or is not authentic, but rather what does it mean for someone to sort of place value in things that they attribute a lot of authenticity to, and what does that do for them? Emotionally, morally, and aesthetically.
Okay, great. So in the book, you're especially focusing on authenticity and the idea of an authentic or true or real nature. And what you show is that the division between nature and culture is something that zoos have to actively produce, so that this is a site to look at how the nature-culture divide gets created through the lens of authenticity. And one of the things that I found striking that you did such an admirable job returning to in each of the chapters was to point out how zoos are a microcosm for thinking about life in the Anthropocene. So I wonder if you could say more about zoos sort of representing the fact that the Earth is now a human-created environment, a human-created ecosystem, just like zoos.
No, sure. So the Anthropocene is a concept that many geologists use to refer to the fact that human activity throughout the history of civilizations, but particularly during the Industrial Revolution and the last 100 years of the Industrial Revolution in particular, have forever transformed the very materiality of the earth itself. And so we can see in rocks below the surface of the earth, we can see, we can see the ways in which the actual earth itself has been modified by atomic weapons testing, by 150 years of fossil fuel use. And we particularly see this with the rise of the climate change crisis, as we see that human-induced activities, again, including the emission of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and nitrogen and methane, but also other kinds of human activities like deforestation and livestock farming, have changed the average temperature of the earth, have changed the amount of ozone in the atmosphere, have changed the average rates of extinction of animals. And so today animals become extinct at a rate 1,000 times a baseline. Compared to if humans had not impacted the earth with such a large human footprint. And so for me, the zoo is a great place to sort of look at what we think of as the natural world as something that is man-made, and something that ultimately that we are all responsible for, in a way.
Okay, so thinking about how the categorical division really breaks down, it's something that experientially has to be created in many sites, and zoos are emblematic of this. One of the main points of the book also seems to be to point out that there's competing missions of zoos. They're supposed to be educational, but also to entertain people and also care about the safety and well-being of animals as well. So you're showing how all of these different missions of living together come together in the zoo. And one of the key concepts for you early on is also nature making as a process. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to ask you more about that. I'm going to hand the mic over to Michelina.
Sure.
Your book focuses on the culture of nature, especially with regards to zoos. Why did you choose zoos to exemplify the culture of nature as opposed to another group of organizations that influence and are involved in the culture of nature?
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot of times, when you're doing this kind of research, the project finds you instead of you seeking out the project. And so the zoo happened to be just the place where I was. I was spending a lot of time with my son, who was born just around the time I was looking for a new research project. And he and I were going to the zoo almost every weekend. And it was at the zoo that I began to start to make all of these different kinds of connections to look at the ways in which animal exhibits could be seen as sort of staged sets, where nature could be reproduced on a micro scale, much in the same way that we reproduce the natural world outside the zoo, as well. It also seemed to me to be a place where, as a social world, there were a lot of different competing participants who were all thinking about the meaning of the zoo in fundamentally different kinds of ways, whether a place of entertainment or a place of education, a place for, you know, or a place for the care of animals. Essentially, I mean, you wind up finding people that work at the zoo that are oriented, some are oriented toward human visitors and audiences, and then others are oriented toward the animals that reside at the zoo. And so the zoo became a place where you wind up seeing these same kinds of nature, culture, boundaries sort of continue to replicate themselves over and over again. And so to me, that became sort of a perfect place to sort of look at this puzzle of how people sort of, you know, create authenticity and invest meaning in it in these kinds of manufactured and staged environments.
Yeah, and invest in other ways as well. One of the most shocking things I found in your book was seeing how commodified so many things were and seeing the price tag of the annual rental from the Republic of China for one of their panda bears, for example, of $1.1 million a year. Just that this is really big business. And one of the accomplishments is that zoos at times in this competing mission to both educate and also take care of their bottom line to commercialize, end up sanitizing the reputations of the very corporations that are causing environmental degradations and the things that the zoos are educating against. So the Exxon Mobil Tiger exhibit, for example, seems particularly ironic. So I wonder if you could say more about how this tension affects the educational programming that zoos actually do. How do we see the consequences of the financial stakes of zoos playing out in education programs?
No, sure. So zoos are reliant on both funding from corporate donors and from and from revenue generated at the turnstile. Based on attendance rates, and so as a result, although zoos do make the claim to be centers of environmental education and scientific research, in point of fact, they try to do this without upsetting upsetting the cart by biting the hand that feeds them, and so we wind up seeing two things take place at the zoo. The first is because zoos rely on mass audiences that may hold a diversity of religiosity and ideology and belief, zoos go out of their way to sort of de-emphasize the process of human evolution. And this was something that was really surprising to me. A second thing, though, is that zoos tend not to emphasize climate change, particularly climate change's causes, as being the result of human activities, again, particularly fossil fuel emissions. And I have to say that in part this seems to be because so many oil and petroleum companies give so much to zoos, again, like Exxon, like BP, and so zoos often portray climate change as what I call a crisis without a cause. And so they will discuss sort of climate change and rising sea levels and the way that that is impacting the world without pointing to its causes in monopoly capitalism, in the Industrial Revolution, and in the particularly egregious acts of, again, of major petroleum companies. And so you see this in all sorts of sort of bizarre ways, right? And so the BP, Deep Horizon, oil spill, was a perfect opportunity to talk about how corporate malfeasance and irresponsibility could lead to this extraordinary crisis in the Gulf, and yet Zeus didn't spend any time talking about sort of pollution or where pollution comes from, or the ways in which BP was responsible for that oil spill. And you can see this with, you know, all sorts of other kinds of disasters that impact the natural world that are the cause of, again, corporate irresponsibility. And Zeus, again, tried to sort of stay away from that ground, rather than sort of really leading the charge against you know, the activities of the fossil fuel industry and these kinds of corporations.
Okay, yeah. Through the zoo programming itself and the bizarre ways that it gets managed, we can see the boundary work between nature and culture getting made inside the zoo. But there are also factors from the corporate media that come into the zoo from outside sources, namely the paying customers. And here I'm going to hand the mic over to Troy.
Sure.
Professor Grossi, throughout the book, you mentioned how influential pop culture characters are in the entertainment value of zoos. Kids call Clownfish Nemo and want to see a bird that looks like Cleveland Rio. Are animal pop culture references born out of a natural human gravitation to particular animals, or is the connection through pop culture constructed to highlight particular animals for conservation, financial, or other reasons?
Can you repeat, Laura, can you repeat part of the crux of the question?
Yeah, so the main point of the question is how pop culture and the media industry shapes the way that people interact with zoo animals and with the zoo ecosystem.
No, sure. The biggest way is, and you see this in the ways that that visitors have this expectation that animals will entertain them or perform for them, or at the very least will interact with them. And my sense is that this comes from the ways in which animals have been anthropomorphized in popular culture. And it's not just in contemporary popular culture, right? I mean, we can see sort of, you know, since the age of, you know, Aesop, right, the sort of the attribution of human characteristics to animals. But what, you know, what the world of Disney and pop culture more generally has created, right, is sort of an atmosphere where humans feel as though animals are put on display to entertain. To interact with them in funny or humorous ways. Very often, visitors will get very annoyed if the animal seems not to be paying attention to them. So in a certain sense, they're also performing for the animals, and they get annoyed when the animals aren't paying attention. It also leads to all sorts of disappointment among visitors who have the expectation that animals are going to behave at the zoo, or that animals behave in the wild the way that they do in movies and on television. And so, right, the male lion, for instance, is at rest 20 hours a day, and that's in the wild and at the zoo. But people don't associate sort of lions with, you know, just kind of laying around, doing nothing or sleeping. And so they feel kind of gypped in a way when they see when they see a lion at rest at the zoo, and they'll scream at it. They'll try to bang on its on the glass walls of its enclosure to wake it up. And again, and my sense is that this comes from the sort of expectation that that kids, but also adults, get from the pop cultural landscape, that animals are these, you know, cute furry creatures that are put on the earth to amuse humans and perform with and interact with them. You know, you have to remember the other kind of animal that people that humans are most apt to interact with are pets. And so people very often try to interact with animals, with the animals at the zoo, as if they were domesticated dogs and cats. And even at times comparing the wild cats at the zoo, for instance, to their own kitties that they have back home.
One of the most remarkable things in reading the great field notes that you reported in the book is that animals are really boring a lot of the time. And the expectation that they're also not supposed to do grown-up things in public. So no sex, no vomiting, although I guess that's adults don't have an exclusive hold on vomiting. But the idea that lying around and doing naughty or unsanitary things are not what's supposed to happen in a zoo. So again, this management. Now, to follow up, by way of follow up, I want to pass the mic over to Ellen for a question.
Building off of what you had just discussed about viewing animals through the lens of entertainment, Chapter 5 of the book takes a critical perspective of how the digital world has distorted perceptions and expectations of animals through films, cartoons, and stuff like that. So, in your opinion, how could the use of technology be better adapted to serve more educative purposes?
I'm sorry. So was the basic question, how could digital technology be wielded in order to improve zoos or to create a better sort of world of interaction between humans and animals?
That kind of thing. We'd also be interested in your view as a sociologist on how media works its magic, how films, photography works to mediate.
Well, you know, so one of the interesting things, right, one of the ironies of zoos, right, is that when people go to the zoo, what they want to see is not quite the real thing. Because what they think of as the real animal is actually this idealized representation of the animal. And so when they see the actual lion at the zoo, it fails to impress in the way that a lion does in a nature documentary, where a camera crew has staked out you know, land in the Serengeti for, you know, days or months, trying to sort of capture these animals on film in just the right light. And so as a result, the 4D IMAX movies that portray sort of, you know, animals in these natural settings in sort of big budget documentaries wind up competing with the actual visuals that visitors can actually experience at the zoo. And it becomes really, really tricky, right, for the zoo to be able to sort of sell its own version of reality when the digitized version seems so much more appealing and to a certain extent seems so much more real, given that those images are filmed on location. You know, although it's important to remember that, you know, the context in which that filming takes place also relies on the same kinds of technologies of staging that zoos rely on in order to create what passes for a natural habitat for an animal. But to talk about sort of what digital technology does offer us. I mean, one of the things it offers us is a way to appreciate endangered animals or very large animals or intelligent animals that it may not make a lot of sense for us to continue to breed in captivity and display on exhibit. And so, for instance, at the end of the book, I talk about how many zoos have gotten rid of their elephant collections because they realize that they can't take care of them to the fullest extent that those animals deserve. There's an argument to be made that highly intelligent mammals, whether they be orcas or gorillas and chimpanzees, perhaps not be continued to be bred in captivity, and those still with us released into larger sanctuaries. And the sort of digital technology that gets us extraordinarily close to those endangered animals that do live in the few habitats that they do have can give people the experience of being up close in a way that a lot of contemporary zoos can no longer really provide for themselves. And lately, there's been all this interesting work with small video cameras placed in actual not only in zoo enclosures but actual animal habitats in the wild. You know, I use wild in quotes there because the wild, we don't associate the wilderness with camera crews. But these can provide this way for us to be able to view animals in their natural habitat and see how they live their lives and the beauty and the majesty that their reality represents for us.
Your book does such a nice job of showing and giving the historical context for the pushback against captivity, keeping animals in captivity, and even the cloning programs that are going on in contrast to various captive breeding programs. One of my favorite moments in the book also was when your son and his friend were particularly inspired by the squirrel in the zoo garbage can, even though that's not something they're supposed to be have awe about. And we're also cheering because of the Philadelphia Zoo. So you're based in Philadelphia, and of course we're in Tennessee. That Philly Zoo shipped its elephants to Tennessee, so we had a little bit of a gold star for ourselves down here.
That's right.
But thinking a bit more about the place of nature or the category of nature and how you're unpacking it, I'm going to hand the mic over to Paul for his question to follow up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, Dr. Grazia. My question is, in Chapter 8 of your book, you argue that zoos should exhibit fewer species with greater depth with focus on lesser known or popular species for exhibitions. So going back to nature documentaries, do you think this attitude should be reflected in them as well as tend to focus on the same animals that contemporary zoos do?
Well, so actually, I want to, I would direct your attention to this amazing movie called Microcosmos, which is largely about the world of very, very small animals, mostly insects, and just in the same way that. You know, a few years ago, we saw this explosion of movies like A Bug's Life and Ants and a human-sized view of of the micro natural world. A film like Microcosmos actually provides this sort of wonderful way to look at the ground of a forest. Again, at that small scale, and this is also a film that could only be made with very special digital cameras that could capture an incredible resolution the complexity of insects. And I would say that, and I would include insects as certainly a kind of zoo animal that while considered somewhat controversial, because there are certainly a lot of visitors that don't consider insects to be a typical zoo animal at all, they do tend to excite young children, particularly because they can get up really close to them. And a lot of zoos have started to use insects in order to talk about natural processes like composting and sort of the life and the sort of the life cycle of the forest. And they give us an opportunity to present really the wonders of nature in a way that don't require the same kind of investment in land. They don't require the density of mammal exhibits. That don't give that much space to these larger beasts. So, in a way, we can see how popular culture itself also tries to, we see this particularly in the latest Disney movie, Zootopia, where there is an emphasis on both small animals as well as large animals. And I think these kinds of distinctions, are tend to get somewhat lost on children who are simply enchanted by the range of the animal kingdom from the largest animal to the smallest.
In contrast to the charismatic macrofauna, you nicely spend a lot of time talking about your field work as a volunteer with uncharismatic microfauna and your fun with cockroaches and trying to get them to sell to the paying customers. But I also just want to flag for listeners that there's really wonderful reflections and arguments about the labor force of zoos and how the very low wage labor force relates to animals, also relates to each other, and the incredible disparity in incomes. Highly educated people getting not very much money compared to people like the CEOs and especially the marketing directors, given that zoos are such big business. Now, I want to start wrapping up here and ask you to think a little bit about the title of the book, American Zoo. And for this, I'm just going to hand the mic over to Carly.
Mm-hmm. Professor Grazian, we're interested in kind of expanding our discussion to a 30,000 foot view, per se. And you focus a lot, or almost the entirety of your book, on the American Zoo. But how does your point of the construction of the natural world play into international, or play internationally and into work in international zoos?
Sure. One thing to say about this is, when people talk to me about other kinds of experiences and interactions that they've had with animals, particularly abroad, they often make reference to going on an African safari. And what's interesting is that they begin to discover that those safaris are sort of also be staged to a certain extent, right? You wind up you're visiting animals that are in highly protected spaces of quote unquote wilderness. The the safari leaders are bring the tour guides bring their tours to demarcated areas where they'll be able to see the kind of animals that American tourists want to see. And in fact, there is this strange irony in the fact that one of the things that trophy hunting does in African countries is it increases the value of live predators like lions that may otherwise attack livestock or get into a farmer's fields. And so one of the things that trophy hunting does is it encourages farmers to figure out ways to protect their own livestock without actually going out and shooting these animals themselves. But you know, one of the things that I hope people get from the book is just simply that it gives them a way to look at the ways in which a lot of the settings in which humans try to interact with the natural world are also manufactured and highly designed for our benefit. I don't think it makes our experiences of those places, whether they be national parks or forest preserves, I don't think it makes that experience of them any less meaningful or magical. But the sooner we can sort of get around this imaginary distinction between culture and nature, the closer we get to coming to terms with the most immediate crisis at hand, which is the environmental and climate change crisis, where we see those sort of boundaries between culture and nature irrevocably broken forever.
Many of the programs that are going on that you think are good examples are in the global south. And one of the things that zoos do through their programming you show is sort of perpetuate this mythic place of Africa, of South America, these sorts of things, often in unhelpful ways. So I just want to say, by way of wrap up to listeners, that you are an incredibly generous scholar with other contemporary workers in areas like sociology of culture and animals, and also historians. And I've never seen in recent years such great use of Emile Durkheim as well in thinking about totems and animals. So it's inevitable, though, that to read a book like this and not ask the how should we live sort of question. So for this, I'm going to hand it over to Kyan.
Professor Grazian, how did your research and experiences in making this book affect your own conservation efforts, if at all?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's made me just feel racked with guilt every minute of the day. because as we begin to realize the toll that humans have taken on the earth. One thing that I have to admit about the project is, and I don't really mention this in the book, but I can tell you, when I started this project, I didn't actually have any affection for animals at all. I'd always found zoos to be interesting places, and I had always found animals to be fascinating. I never really sort of approached animals with anything like affection, though. And I found that working at the zoo and spending so much time with the same animals day after day gave me this kind of appreciation for these animals that I had never really had before. And I have to say, the other thing that did that for me was spending so much time around zookeepers, who, as Laura mentioned, I write in the book, are college educated, college-educated workers. They are largely women, and they get paid very, very little for the work that they do and the care that they give to these animals that they feel so deeply toward. And it was by spending a lot of time, not just with these animals, but with these zookeepers, that I gained a kind of appreciation for non-human animals in a way that I don't think I had before. And I'm not quite sure if it makes me a better sociologist, but I feel like it does make me probably a better father and maybe a better person.
Yeah, well, I guess we have to be people and sociologists as well all at the same time. One of the things I really admired also about the book is that when it's so easy to be ironic and exclusively critical, you're also constructive, so deeply ambivalent about the potential for zoos. But you seem to think, despite the problems teaching about things like evolution because of how it affects funding streams, there still might be a possibility for zoos teaching about the natural sciences. And despite all of the strange and unfortunate ways people interact in zoos, there's still possibly a good example of Elijah Anderson's cosmopolitan canopy, where a variety of groups can come together in one particular urban space. So I just want to thank you on behalf of everyone here for writing a fantastic book, for taking lots of time to talk with us and fielding our questions. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, sure. Thanks a lot, guys, for reading my book.